You are listening to Citizen Reporter at citizenreporter.org.
I am Tre Hanul. I'm a photographer, a graphic designer, an arts teacher, a traveler, an avid motorbiker, a storyteller, now also a writer, and last but not least, a coffeeholic.
So glad that in the last, even in just the last 2 weeks, I was at an event related to travel, specifically motor cycling, but cycling in general, and empowerment of women traveling. And long story short, I was listening and noticing the comments from a specific participant at that event, started reading more about her, and well, here she is. Tre, welcome to this podcast. So glad to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really thrilled. You're like the first podcaster who's ever interviewed me. I've been on radio shows, yeah, like short things, a bit longer things, but never ever on a podcast. So you got the first.
Oh, well, I do consider myself very lucky. And I was interested also, like, your connection with motorcycles, mm-hmm, and then maybe later also your connection to photography. They all come, mm-hmm, together in many ways. But like for you, when did, especially motorcycling, when did this start?
I think the traveling started before motorbiking. Mm. So I consider myself a traveler first and foremost. Yeah. And if I would have lived like 200 years ago or 500 years ago, and I would have belonged to a middle upper class, or let's say an upper class, I would be riding horses. I mean, it's just the kind of thing that just thrills me, the speed, yeah, like the engine, the device, a vehicle that sort of like connects, yeah, brings you further away than you can. Yeah, walking is great. And walking is very great for thinking. I mean, I do walk a lot while I think.
Yeah.
And but for covering some distances, I prefer to have something faster. Sure. So it would have been a horse.
Yeah.
But now horses are a bit impractical, you know, and my parents were never, they're like middle class, and I wanted to ride horses when I was young, but this was like upper class stuff,
yeah,
when I was young. And so we just basically couldn't afford it. So I went to arts class. I went to music school, you know, this kind of thing, but I just couldn't ride horses.
Yeah.
So I have never been around bikes or horses just by myself or in my family. It was just the thing that was like, I think I'm a romantic soul, basically. Uh-huh. And it's sort of like, it's like this adventure side of horses and motorcycles that sort of connected with me as a kid already.
Yeah.
So I started riding that's by now 24 years ago, 25 years ago, in 1994 to be precise. Yeah. So just out of nowhere, because I just happened to have a friend and he had a motorcycle. And so I was going on the back, and then finally things got together and I was like, I want to learn how to ride. You know, yeah, it was like some kind of epiphany, like all of a sudden this childhood dream came back to me and it was like, yes, this, yeah, is what I want to do.
Yes.
And then it changed everything after. But before all this, you have to interrupt me if I'm talking too much.
No, before any of the motorcycling, yeah.
Before any of the motorcycling, there was the traveling.
Yeah.
So my parents traveled as kids. They would take us with the caravan to then Yugoslavia.
Oh, yeah.
The Balkans, sure, which was unusual, even at that time. So I really love my parents for taking us that far out of Central, like Western, yeah, Europe. Yeah. And then when I was 18, 19, of course, I was studying. And of course, I had no money, like all students had no money. And I was hitchhiking. This was the time that hitchhiking was like massive. I mean, everybody was hitchhiking. So I started hitchhiking first close by and then all over Europe. I've hitchhiked from Finland to Italy and from the west of England to the borders of like Eastern Europe. I mean, I've just crisscrossed for like 5 to 6 years by myself as a girl. And so I was beating all speed records, you know, because I was a girl and by myself.
Yeah.
I was faster than trains.
Yeah. Hey, the by myself element, it's a very interesting one. And part of it is personal. I too have found that, I don't even know exactly why, but I've traveled alone a lot in my life. Sometimes by choice, but sometimes I didn't even know. I just was going. What led you there? Because I definitely noticed, you know, neighbors, friends that are young now, you know, university age, and they want to travel with their friends. It's the sort of default. But you didn't do that from the get-go. You went alone.
It was a bit coincidence. I mean, sometimes I traveled with a friend, like one. Mm-hmm. Never in groups, because the dynamics of groups just don't work for me. I mean, it's just too difficult.
Yeah.
And like two works, four works, and three doesn't.
Right.
You know, like uneven figures don't work. That's my experience. But so, and I rarely traveled with more than two. And if it was two, it usually was my lover of that time.
Sure.
At some point, which started something like 6, 7, 8 years ago, I found myself being single.
Yeah.
And it was either sit at home and sulk or just go.
Yeah.
And I remember very well the very first time, not for short journeys, it doesn't matter, but for longer journeys, I actually prefer to be with two people.
Okay.
I do. Yeah. But I just don't have a choice. So,
sure.
And as it happens, now I feel more and more comfortable being by myself,
yeah.
Just traveling by myself. But the thing with traveling with two people, especially someone that is very close to you, not necessarily a lover, but very few people get so close to you, you know? So, you know, I always say, if you have something beautiful, it's like, the beauty doubles when you're two, and the sadness halves. I mean, it's like if you watch a beautiful mountain, you're by yourself. It's a beautiful mountain all the same. But if you're two and you can share that experience, it becomes like even nicer. In Dutch.
Okay.
Gedeelde vrucht is dubbele vrucht. Gedeeld verdriet is half verdriet. So shared beauty is double beauty.
Yeah.
Shared sadness or shared bad moments or half of them.
Yeah. So the advantage to be sharing.
Yeah. So cases. I'm still convinced of that because,
yeah.
I mean, if things go wrong and you're by yourself, I mean, it's all perfect if everything goes perfect. But
right.
You and I know that it doesn't always.
Right.
And often doesn't. And
yeah.
Sometimes it's not so bad. And sometimes it's really dramatic. If you fall ill on a journey, you all of a sudden become weak in a way. And that's physical, but that's also mentally. So I found myself in situations where I felt like very vulnerable and very weak. Facing the outside world, like for 10 days in India a long time ago. And it's still to this day, it stayed with me as something I don't want to repeat, you know?
Yeah. There's a couple of directions I want to go here based on what you've been talking about. One is, this element of traveling alone and how people receive you or engage with you. I mean, I think
sure.
When you're one and you arrive in a village or a city, but certainly in a smaller place, so what was your first big ride to another country? And also, were you alone or with one person?
The very first journeys I did, I happened to be by myself. I just took an airplane to Indonesia. It was my first long journey, 3 months backpacking back in the 80s. Then the second one was India, again, almost 3 months backpacking by myself. And that was just, coincidence. As I said, I didn't have anyone at the time, so I just started traveling. Yeah. And then I started learning to how to ride a motorcycle, and I had the long-term relationship at that time. Mm-hmm. So we were traveling, two girls on two motorcycles, overland from Belgium to India and back. Huh. And we did that twice for 7 months.
Yeah.
And coming back to the topic of your question, is indeed I can compare very well, but I have the very big advantage, I think, mm-hmm. is traveling with two women is a very different thing than traveling as a man and a woman. Or even two men.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're almost perceived in a similar way alone than with two women. People, of course, if you're alone, people approach you.
Yeah.
If you want it or not. I mean, so sometimes you're like, leave me alone. I just want to read this book, you know?
Yeah.
Which, like, in India, I tried this, I tried it on a bus stop. It just didn't work. And, I was inexperienced then, and now I would just not sit there. I would just choose another place. Anyway, people are always trying to protect you or help you, or especially if you're a woman on your own. And this is also the base of my travel experience. I go from the premise that 97-98% of the people are good people.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't distrust people unless they prove me wrong. And I've been lucky, probably also. So I know that people can have so much bad luck, especially women, but also men. And so I've always been approached more easily when I was alone, for sure. But even being two women, we were approached and we were, people started reaching out to us, invite us and just be quite at ease because we were two women. Like, we were not dangerous in a way. We were not
not suspicious.
Not suspicious, indeed. Yeah, something like that. I think because as a woman, you, of course, if we were on motorcycles, people perceived us as men first and for all, because before you remove your helmet, if you don't have huge boobs and you don't drive in pink, which we didn't, you're perceived as man. And even when removing a helmet, sometimes it was just confusing for people because they just couldn't match the vehicle and then a female on top of it.
I don't even have it open, but I know the you arrive, you're in Iran. And I'm thinking about this because you're talking about that impression before you take your helmet off and then how it goes from there. And in this photo, you're side by side with I believe it's an Iranian, your partner perhaps at that time. And I paid, when I saw this photo, a couple of things, I don't know, I went right to them. One was, I was curious what you were wearing in terms of what you would choose, right, to wear, because it's Iran, the temperature is not clear to me in the photos, but I know that the weather can be sometimes extreme depending on the season. And then on the other hand, I know you're riding, so the protection aspect, physically, comfort. So I see that you have a sort of long flowing, it's not a robe, it's not a shalwar, but you seem to have strategically dressed both for the trip as well as the context, it would seem.
That's the very first time we were crossing from, it was at the border, exactly, border from Turkey to Iran. Mm. And it was the very, very first time we were going in to Iran. And this was 1999. So we had talked to one woman who had traveled across Iran on her motorcycle on the way back from India to London. Mm-hmm. That was the only woman that we knew of that had who had ridden through Iran, because before we started this planning, we didn't even know that it was allowed.
Right.
We were not even sure. So because of this one woman, we just decided to give it a go, because Iran happens to be on the way from Europe to India. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's there. It's a massive country that you have to cross if you want to go from Turkey to Pakistan and India. Yeah. So I'm smiling on that photograph.
Yes.
And my girlfriend, it not. Was like very, I mean, we were both super tense because we had no idea what to expect.
Yeah.
And because you cross into Iran, and you know that even today, the rules in Iran for women is cover your hair and cover your female bodily shapes.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was quite conservative still. I mean, so we had found Iranian chadors, well, more or less, with like a black long robe up to the ankles, and then black scarves and helmet on top. And under these dresses, we had all our protective gear.
Right.
So we looked like hulks,
you
really.
Look like American football players.
Exactly.
Actually, the shoulder,
exactly.
Especially the shoulder. It looks
so
heavy.
Needless to tell, that we were not very comfortable in these robes.
Yeah.
And they were long, so it was really a struggle to keep them away from the exhaust.
Yeah, you know, it's dangerous.
Keeping from going from the ropes going in up into flames. You know, that.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Iran, as I see it now, because I've been seven times now, I can compare 1999 to 2022.
Okay.
And all the stages in between. So that's a super, let me add, this is a superficial view from an outsider, just a female traveler to Iran, nothing else. Mm. So I'm not a historian, I'm not a social or political scientist or a journalist, I'm nothing of that. I'm just a curious traveler, let's say. So it's an outsider's view, but what I've seen, one of the superficial things was that fashion changed rapidly every time I went to Iran, and changed in a way for the better. I mean, for me as a woman.
Yeah.
So the black robes 3 years later were way too long. People were staring at us when we walked in 2002, when we came into Iran, and women were just like, whoa, what are these? I mean, these are like very traditional extremists. They almost looked at us like terrorists, you know, in their own country. So we just hurried to the bazaar to get something much more fashionable for the fashion of the time, which was shorter. Mm-hmm. And now I've seen in 2022, which was like 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I saw some women with a long shirt, like just reaching under their buttons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And headscarves that were like so light and flimsy and so much backward that you could hardly see they were wearing one.
The changes, so that being able to see the changes, what you're saying is that it's actually been quite a continuous path, if you were going to say forward or backward, forward towards basically less restricting clothing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. That's on the surface. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah,
that's
just a superficial sign. And women are still, every single woman I talked to, even in 2007, women or 2014 or other years, that was the one thing that women wanted to get rid of, this obligation of wearing a headscarf mostly.
Yeah.
And of course, there's women who are very religious and they will continue to wear it, but not having the choice is very annoying for many women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember going to Tunisia after Ben Ali was kicked out, and Ben Ali had banned the headscarf, or at least during his time. So in an odd or not so odd aftermath or reaction, many people wanted to wear the headscarf and did, as a sign of a sort of the new era. Anyway, very, very different in many ways, but also interesting when you think about the restrictions.
Right, yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Three, in more elements of your traveling that we haven't gotten to yet, of course, you're a skilled photographer. Yes?
I consider myself still a beginning photographer. I have a master in photography, so I studied it,
sure.
But I didn't do the bachelor's. So I don't know. This is a technical thing in Belgium that was possible. Huh. But even that aside, I mean, so many photographers didn't even study anything and don't have a degree and are still incredible master photographers. But I think my problem a little bit, my advantage, and it's also a problem, mm-hmm. is that I'm broad-minded, mm-hmm. so I tap into different skills and different tools that I have. So I like to write as well.
Yes.
I like to make a little bit of video. I like to interact with people. I'm a graphic designer as well. I love graphic design.
Yes.
And I'm also a photographer. So what I'm trying to say is, like, I'm trying to become a better photographer every time I photograph. And I'm quite well informed about what exists today and what has existed in the past. So I know about visual language, about the concepts, of documentary photography, for instance, about the trouble with that as well. I'm trying to become a better photographer. That's actually the thing.
And so you've undertaken this project. It looks to me like a passion project for sure, which is photographing women who move, you know, and whether it's motorcycles, bicycles, bus drivers, surfers. I mean, how did you arrive at this concept and then pursue it and actually get these particular examples?
Move She Does is a storytelling project about pioneering women and girls blazing trails with their vehicles. In short, women and girls face obstacles moving in public spaces, be it prejudices, traditions, prohibitive laws, and violence. All over the world, courageous, creative women have found, or still find, ways to overcome these obstacles. Using all kinds of vehicles, they challenge gender stereotypes, gain independence, self-confidence, and strength. Each one of them changes her society from within and becomes a role model, inspiring others to follow suit. The project is delving into a large array of ages, cultures, classes, backgrounds, and vehicles. So I'm really going to travel in a large number of countries, and I will look for a big diversity of all ages, all vehicles, all classes. And vehicles can go from airplanes to trucks to bicycles, surfboards and skateboards, cars, and obviously, because I'm a biker myself, motorcycles. The project consists of portraits in photographs in a specific style that I chose. of interviews, context, audio recordings, and short videos. And the purpose is spreading all these stories through as widely as possible.
I've been traveling a few times to countries where I felt that I shouldn't be traveling to. I was in Congo in 1991, when Mobutu was still in power. And it's the one country and the one time and place that I really felt out of place as a visitor. Mm. And it stuck with me. I mean, it was an amazing journey. I can write a book of this 4 weeks alone. But more and more when I was traveling, it's the pleasure of curiosity, of meeting people, of seeing countrysides that you couldn't even dream up. Being in the extreme heat, being in extreme cold, just living all these experiences and learning. Because this is, for me, a very important aspect of traveling is learning. Yeah. I consider myself like an eternal student all along, whether I'm in Belgium or whether I'm on the road. And obviously, on the road, I learn even faster. Because you have to. I mean, you have to adapt to what's happening around you. And this is not predictable. Yeah. So, but little by little, I wanted to bring back stories and talk about this here in one or another way. So, and more, I wanted somehow to make this even bigger and share even more, and to share the inspiring stories that I found, sharing these inspirations with other people so that they could inspire others as well. Really started with the book that Gaia Schutters and I made back in 2007 from a journey, 9 Muslim countries, 7 months on the road, 30,000 kilometers on 2 motorcycles through Turkey, Iran, the whole of Central Asia, Dubai, Oman, and Yemen. And we made a book after this, like 1/3 photos, 2/3 text. And after that, we gave I lost count, but like 200 lectures in all kinds of groups. So elderly people up to 6-year-olds in schools. And it was amazing the effect, especially in schools, the effect you can have as a storyteller, telling stories that you genuinely lived on the road, like authentic stories that you of women and girls, or just even men that you met on the road. It's just like the ears of these kids, they just glow.
You know, I'm also thinking you had these experiences traveling, meeting people, journeys across borders. A lot of those countries that you mentioned are very different now. Well, look, every country changes, but some have changed in bigger ways. You mentioned Yemen briefly. It flashed through my head how much Yemen has changed, but even Dubai in a positive sense or building sense also has changed easily. I don't even know the year you were there, but it's guaranteed that from then to now, it has changed because it never stops that particular city. But one thing I think about a lot, Trey, and I don't know where you land on this, so I'll ask, travel in itself has changed a lot in the last, I'm going to say 20 years for me. And that is to say, a lot of the journeys that you made, first of all, they were to places, just like you mentioned with your parents, they were to places where not everybody was going. Wasn't that easy necessarily to get in. A lot of risks, adventure. And the other thing was that, people didn't travel as much. It required a lot of the individual to be brave enough, to be curious enough. But we now live in this time, especially where you and I live. You're in Belgium, I'm in the Netherlands. People travel very easily. To certain places anyway. It's really a click away. And what's required of you is pretty minimal. When you get there, you could pretty much do what you do at home. You know, the kind of traveling I'm talking about now. This is average tourism. And what strikes me is I was a big traveler, and then Corona hit. and then baby. So, you know, things have changed. But I'm at a loss sometimes for, on the one hand, travel and meeting individuals will always be a good thing for the soul, for the mind, for our globe. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, what we've created, and I take, you know, responsibility as well as someone who traveled, what we've created is a very different experience from, I think, what you're describing, meeting people, learning, or I don't know, am I... You know, am I putting up the past in a pedestal? I feel like travel has now gone in, maybe there's 2-3 different levels of it now. And some of it is not necessarily good for humanity. I mean, it's a strong sort of, you know, raising my fist. If the camera was on, you'd see me going, you travelers, you know, tourism for countries, it's a good thing in terms of income, but it's also a bad thing environmentally, depending on how you do it. For the individual, it should be a learning experience, but you can also learn nothing. I'm very divided on travel these days.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've talked about this in another podcast that I listened to about the difference between tourism and traveling.
Maybe I'm really stuck on this.
Yeah, tell me.
No, I think I might be stuck on this issue if you tell me you've heard me.
No, but it's a very interesting thing. And I don't have, like you, I don't have the arrogance to say I'm the better tourist or I'm the better traveler at all, because I'm part of the problem, you know. It's a very interesting topic to think about, and we need to think about it, like travel more sustainably, make sure that the money goes to the right hands, like fair trade travel, try to keep down our footprints, and then a motorcycle is not the best way, and flying to a country is not the best way. But, you know, there's so many aspects of it that, for me, I consider myself as a traveler, not as a tourist, but that seems like, saying again, I feel better. And I don't, I struggle with this. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons also why I want to still travel, but bring something in return, do something in return, like collect these stories. Go and meet people in totally untouristy places, like in villages or in a town that nobody would ever go to, and work with a translator, with an interpreter, for instance. It changed so much this last time in Iran, because I was working twice with just traveling along with someone who could translate. And it just opens up a whole new chapter, you know. You just, all of a sudden, you're not restricted to people with a certain level of education or with contact with foreigners, you know. So, and I think that's one of the reasons why I want to do something in return. That's probably the core of it, because I feel if I'm just traveling and enjoying the mountains in whatever, like in Bhutan or wherever, okay, that's fine. Then I'm there for like a week or 2 weeks, and I enjoy, and I come back. And I talk about it to friends, and I show pictures, or I post them on Instagram, you know. And to me, it's like a very hollow, a very superficial experience then, I think.
And I think about that, and I hear very clearly what you're saying by what you do, because if I look through your photos of your journey, this is a very different thing than someone who goes, takes pictures of a interesting looking person who maybe is, yeah, sure, riding a motorcycle or no, you are not just taking a photo, you're telling a story of a person, you're giving context, you're giving them a voice. I mean, one of the first photos I saw of yours was the stunt driver from Iran, Noura.
Mm-hmm. And
I noticed she has an Instagram. Well, guess who follows her Instagram now? You know, I do, because now mm-hmm. I want to know more about this person. And I'm excited that her life is going, like, you know, trials and tribulations, successes, failures. I'm glad mm-hmm. she's out there.
mm-hmm.
And now you brought that person. In a way, mm-hmm. Who wanted to mm-hmm. be brought, apparently, because they have an Instagram account and
exactly. Yeah. This is nothing illegal, nothing political. I mean, it's just like, this is a woman out in the world and she's having an Instagram, like yeah. probably almost every single story I made in Iran, all these people have Instagrams.
Yeah.
So they're out in the open.
Yeah.
And they're moving boundaries. I mean, every single woman in that project, the eight mm-hmm. stories that I made, they're blazing trails. They're pioneers in one way or another.
Yeah.
And this was now Iran, but I'm going soon to the UK for 6 weeks. And I had a lot of trouble finding the same level of trailblazers, but I did find them.
Okay.
And India is next on the list. Japan is for next spring.
Wow.
And then Bangladesh now came to the fore because of this talk, yeah. for sure. Yeah. I mean, I've been in Bangladesh, but I want to go again.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm going to be working on this project, on Move She Does, for I think the next 4 or 5 years for sure. Yeah. If not six.
That's a wonderful thing.
You listened to citizenreporter.org. You're listening to citizenreporter.org.
Like, how can people who are listening, who are in many ways inspired and interested, how can they best support you and support the project?
I'm always looking for inspiring stories.
Yeah.
And because I'm a motorbiker, I have trouble getting outside of my motorcycle world. You know, like all the links I have. I mean, I can fill three books with inspiring motorbiking women, scooters, motorbikes, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not into sports. So sports, I try to keep it out,
okay.
because it's less of a necessity than, and it's opening a totally different box of Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
And military is out as well,
yeah.
except for in one case, oh. and that's Second World War.
Ah.
But all the rest, I don't do tanks or
sure.
What is it?
Police officer.
Jet planes
fighter
or
pilot.
Anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I'm looking for, actually, it's a, like I said, Move She Does is a storytelling project about mm-hmm. pioneering women, girls, and groups blazing trails with vehicles, with okay. their vehicles.
Yeah.
And it can be almost anything. Like in India, I found in Hyderabad, I found a company that is making electric tuk-tuks now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're supporting a project that is called Moving Women.
Okay.
And one particular group they are reaching out to are the hijras, the transgenders, the traditional transgenders of India.
Yeah.
And now a bunch of transgenders are learning how to ride these electric tuk-tuks and making money in a very different way than what they usually do, being sex workers in general, very often. So now they're making their way and earning a living in this way, which I find super interesting. So anything goes. I mean, it could be bicycles, it could be skateboards and surfboards are in there as well, as the community thing, not the sports side of things.
No, right.
But very often they reach communities which would normally stay out of view, or one project that came to the fore like 10 years ago even already was Skatistan in Afghanistan. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not, and I've been to Afghanistan twice, and I did not know about Skatistan, I don't think.
Wow, okay.
So
yeah, Skatistan, and this is a very interesting story as well, just to give you a little bit of the type of stories that I'm looking at or searching. I'm on a permanent search for sure. Yeah. So anyone who's listening and that's like, whoa, I have this wonderful aunt and she's been riding this incredible truck decorated in Pakistan, and she's the only one in Pakistan. Please reach out, you know, please. But yeah, Afghanistan had 10 years ago, 10, 11, there was a skateboarder who was there for some type of NGO project. And he brought a skateboard and started skating in the streets of Kabul. And all of a sudden he became like attracting like a magnet all these street kids. And he saw, he started teaching these kids. Of course, he had only one board and he got more boards. And in no time, this became his project. And it grew like a mushroom. So what he did was setting up a skate park and then a school connected to that. And then he got the kids of the street. I mean, I'm just probably like ruining the basics. You can find it online, but and then it's going to be better. But this is my how I perceived it. So they started the school. They engaged Afghan teachers. And basically, these kids would skate a couple of times a week and for the rest go to school. And for many of these kids, it was the first time they saw a school from the inside. And the skateboard was like the facilitator, like the cherry on the pie, you know. And they specifically aimed at girls to get more girls into education. And this was Kabul. In a couple of years, I think 5-6 years, of course, they grew and they were funded by an enormous amount of people. People loved this project. And they started a second school, I think, in Herat and a third school in Bamiyan. And and it worked like mad. It was growing. They were building new ramps, new skateboard balls, and new halls, new schools. They also copied the project to Cambodia, to townships in South Africa, I believe in Jordan, and one more country that that escapes my mind. And of course, I don't need to make it clear, in August last year, the whole thing had to shut down. And even worse, they had to find ways for all their staff to escape from the country, which they did. They managed. And guess what?
What?
Three of the Skatistan girls' teachers fled to Belgium. So I met one girl a month ago. I made her portraits. I still have to do her interview. I'm meeting another girl in 10 days' time. And the third girl lives in Antwerp. These two live in Brussels. A third girl lives in Antwerp. And I'm going to do her interview as well, because the first one, Mubaraka, is was actually the first founder of the school in Bamiyan. She was a teacher, but she was also a programmer and cleared the ground for the new school in Bamiyan. And she was also a photographer. She was like the permanent photographer of the website in Afghanistan. Yeah. And there were no credits of her nowhere. There was just like her pictures. Yeah. And now I know that it's hers. These are her pictures. Yeah. So it's just amazing that I wanted to go to Skadistan. I never could because it was Afghanistan and never safe for a foreign visitor in many ways, mm-hmm. I think. And now Skadistan came to me. And of course, it's very sad for her.
Yeah.
But at least I can spread also her story, and hers is an incredible story. Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah, I've seen the two photos of her that you shared with me, and even her face, it tells quite a story. I mean, you have one where she's, I think, she's smiling, and it's an incredible smile. It says a lot anyway to me. And then you have another where she's more pensive and like staring off, and there you also see the sort of other side of all this in a way.
Right, because it's a very tough story as well, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, especially now, and she's separated from her family, and her family is safe as well, but in a totally different country, and it's really tough. She's 25, and she's here by herself, you know.
Yes,
and she's okay, but I cannot begin to imagine how it must be to all of a sudden be projected in a totally different culture.
Yeah,
you know, and just try to move on with things, and she does. She recently set up a photography project in an asylum center.
Oh wow.
Okay. Yeah, so she's not sitting still.
No, I think sometimes for some people in this world there's a personality type that no matter what you like you said, she's still she continues.
She's incredible, really. She's 25, and to me, she's like a massive inspiration. Yeah. I mean, I look at, I'm talking to her, and my jaw drops all the time. You know, every single phase that she's talking about, like she was telling me that she was going to Bamiyan as a girl, as a young woman. I think she was 22, and she had to face the local people before even setting up the school. She had to enter a room with something like 30 men or something, 30, 40 men staring at her. And she had to convince them these were responsibles of the city. Mm-hmm. And she had to convince them of the advantages of setting up a Skadistan in Bamiyan.
Yeah.
And she confessed to me, she said, you know, I was on the verge of starting to cry when I entered that room. Mm-hmm. And then she said, I knew I couldn't, and she just sort of found the strength and the power. And she said, I went in that room and I just talked and I convinced them all.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing, I mean, you're on the verge of like crying, facing something that a young woman facing 30, 40, traditional men trying to convince them to build this school, and finding the power to do that is just like I can just see the thing happening. And when I met her, I was just like all ears when she was telling this.
Wow. Yeah. Wonderful examples. I mean, you've met some fantastic people, and it's also wonderful that you can keep in touch. I mean, that's also the difference between, let's say, travel and tourism, or however we want to phrase it, that the people you meet, the photos you take, they live on, and the individuals matter to you. They're not something you put in a frame and hang on your wall and say, I was there once.
No, not at all. No. I want to spread these stories. It will be a book in 5-6 years. I have the editors.
Yeah.
It will be a website at some point or another.
Yeah.
And I certainly aim to go talk in schools anywhere.
Yes.
And talk in schools together with local women.
Yeah.
Because actually, I'm not so important in this story. I'm like the facilitator.
Right.
And I just want to clear the floor And in many cases, they do by themselves. They don't need me, you know. I mean, for so many places, like moving women. I mean, they're going to schools. They're already doing this. Like Sakia Haq, you know, she's going to schools all the time.
Yes.
They don't need us, you know. No. So sometimes I feel like, maybe I should just walk away and let them do it. I mean, they're perfectly capable of doing this. Yeah. They don't need our help. Yeah. But sometimes I feel like I can be the facilitator. I can be like, they will, it's sad, but like in, I was talking in a school in the Bengali region in Northeast India, in, can't remember the town, but it was in Northeast. Mm. And I was invited to speak in a school, and still I had the impression, but I'm talking to kids who, about my journeys, these kids, these 100 boys and girls, will never, ever in their life be able to do what I'm doing.
Okay.
They don't have the passport, and they don't have the money, and they will never have it, probably, maybe one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what am I doing here? Just making their heads crazy with some romantic, unattainable journey? It's crazy. It's not right, you know? So what I did, I just came back from Bangladesh at that time. So I told them a little bit about my journey. I told them why I was there and what I had seen in their own region and what I liked and what I liked so much about their country and their culture. And then I introduced to them some stories of women that I had met on scooters in Bangladesh, in Dhaka. Yeah. And I felt that that was much more appropriate, because then I could show pictures and show them these women, they're Bengali just as you are, and they have tried, they have struggled, they have faced adversity, they've been stoned even in the streets, they've been pushed over on the scooters, and yet they persisted and they got together and they made a motorcycle club. And that's what I did. And I think that was much more valuable, I think, and much more reachable, because it's something that these kids can relate to, I think.
Yeah, I could see that, definitely. And I think your presence has something, for sure, in the sense of just reminding us, maybe on a simple level, that we are all human, even though it might seem like, you know, your clothes or the way you look might be different, but like, it's, I don't know, I think there's a reminder there about our shared humanity, which is a good starting point. But then, like you say, indeed, like examples that are either from a community or even more within reach, I think that's also, I see the value for sure.
So I want to spread these stories. I mean, they're so inspiring too. And maybe one story might not inspire you as a young girl, and then another story. That's why I want more young girls in it as well. I have now a 12-year-old surfer in the southeast of Iran. And she's the only one in the region, and she's super strong, and she's incredible. But I need more girls, definitely.
Yeah.
I know they are there.
And the funny thing is, so she's from the region of Balochistan, I believe, right?
Yes.
And the interesting is, for me, like Balochistan is famous for this sort of violence, struggle, lawlessness, all negatives is what I've always heard, never having gone or studied, never having gone to the region. And then you see the images, you read the story, you see and surfing, but there it is, you know, it's real. It's someone who's doing this and is inspiring, and it sheds light on, you know, what else is possible in a place, and it's not just, I don't know, what I've heard or what I've read in the media.
Absolutely. And this is so much so true for Iran, for instance. It's one of these countries that has faced, every time I tell someone who doesn't know me, I tell them, I've been there, or I've been, and when I utter the word Iran, it's like people's ears are like, what? You know, there's like this massive prejudice. And then inside Iran, even if I say I'm going to Balochistan, it's the same. People are, oh, are you sure? I mean, it's dangerous. I mean, it's a violent region, like you say. Yeah. And I was accompanied by a young man who's a very dear friend now, who has lived in Chabahar for 4 years. And so we went together. And it was the most hospitable region and hospitable people. They were so warm and so outgoing and so interesting. I've been in a super, super fancy restaurant on top of a hotel somewhere. I couldn't count the expensive cars that came straight from Dubai, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting region because you see what I expected was indeed a very poor and very traditional region.
Yeah.
And okay, I've just spent like 3 days there and I cannot judge.
Yeah.
But I had a little bit of an insider's look because I was traveling with Mohammed. Mm. But, you know, it was so different from what I expected.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you're doubting on something, I think you should go and just try to find out by yourself and try to find out what is your truth and how is your experience and just not let prejudice cloud. I mean, it's always clouding. I mean, but yeah, try to seek below the surface and try to reach out to normal people. Like I said, 97-98% of the people are good people and they want the same, like you and me.
Yeah.
They want a roof. They want some food. They want some health, of course, health care, and some money to be and freedom. They want to have a freedom of speech, a freedom to move. This is also something, and that's basically it. You know, they want to be happy, just like you and me.
Yeah, yeah. It eventually gets very simple in the end.
Yeah. Mm.
Trey, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. And the beauty of podcasting, of course, is that we can go as long as we want, but...
Sure, but you have to cut. You have to cut in this, you
know? Or just, you know, I think that these stories are so wonderful that I'm really pleased that we could... Let's say this is a start. This is our first conversation. I very much would like to speak to you again and talk about more adventures and more ideas. So this is a wonderful start. I'm so thankful that you were open to being on the program. And I'm going to enjoy publishing this and sharing it. And by all means, count me in when you think about all the things you want to do with Move She Does. I realize who I am and all that. But if there's a role for me to play, I will play it. You call on me.
Wow, Mark, that's amazing. Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be on your podcast, even, and to have met you. I mean, this is like amazing. We should meet in real life.
We'll get there.
300. We're 300 kilometers apart, right?
Yeah, it should.
I should come over and have coffee with you and your kid.
Let's do it. Thank you so much, and I'll add all the relevant links, including to your website. Move She Does is the name of the campaign, and it's really wonderful. And I can hear from your plans.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm very honored, and I'm not publishing all the stories as yet. This is maybe important to say because I want to be a little bit careful, and there's a little bit of I have to protect some people.
Yeah. Okay.
Not that I'm doing anything illegal, but yeah, there's a side to it that I cannot really talk about.
Okay.
But of course, the English stories and the Indian stories, I mean, they're going to be more. And the story of the Afghan girls is going to be published sooner.
Okay.
So I will give some feed to the website.
Yeah, and I'll make sure, and this is, I think I like sharing this with the audience as well. I definitely want to check with you when I publish this podcast, whatever art I'm going to use, whatever photographs, I'm just going to check with you just to make sure we're respecting everybody the right way. And
Perfect.
Yeah.
Mark, thank you so, so much. And thank you for your help. And thank you, listeners. If you want to reach out via Mark or straight away via my website. And I'd love to find more trailblazing girls and women, for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to citizenreporter.org. To hear more, find your favorite... No, wait, fuck. This is like Marilyn Monroe.